Energy Committee, and we'll go to my left and go around the table. I think we'll have some ground rules, which I think that, to begin with, the people at the table will be doing the talking.
Over here on the edge.
And then we'll see how that works. What's and it? If people in the audience feel some need, there may be a process to recognize them, if not in this meeting, in another meeting. But to begin with, I think the discussion will be limited to the folks at the table, but we'll see what happens. So, John Fuller, on my left.
Karen Hyde with XL Energy.
John Gostavin.
Good morning. Wade Gordon, Fond du Lac Tribal Community College, Cloquet, Minnesota.
Mike Franklin, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce.
George Crocker, North American Water Office and Community-Based Energy Development Initiative.
Mike Bull with the Minnesota Department of Commerce.
Paul Blackburn with Windustry.
Todd Volnoski with John Deere Credit.
Brian Wolf with Wolfson Development.
Dwayne Nenneman from Clean Up the River Environment, Montevideo.
Jim Nichols, farmer and wind turbine owner.
Carl Nelson with Green Institute and also representing Minnesota Project.
Stuart Mitchell, Public Utilities Commission.
Mike Michaud, Consultant, Matrix Energy Solutions.
Dan Jewell, Dan Marr, and Seabed Initiative.
Larry Johnston, Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency.
Bob Eliff, House Research.
And then when people come in later, we can have them introduce themselves. You have a packet in front of you, I believe, and in that packet are a number of items, including an agenda and an expense voucher. You are entitled to file for mileage and meals. I would expect that you are here in your official duties will not be doing that, but certainly the citizens are encouraged to avail themselves of this so they're not disadvantaged financially by participating in this endeavor. So you would turn in Sandy Keene here. Can she stand up? Introduce yourself and tell them what you do, please.
I'm Sandy King with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. We oversee all the joint commissions between the House and the Senate. So all of these expense forms need to be turned in for the co-chairs of the Electric Energy Task Force to sign. Both chairs have to sign it. So if you just want to hand them in at the end of the meeting, we'll make sure they get signed.
And Sandy, how soon would they get their when would they expect to be reimbursed? Or how's
it? They have to be done. If everybody turns them in right away, they get processed faster.
Okay. So, the check will be in the mail. All right. And another thing in your packet is a little digest of some seabed laws, not comprehensive. We will be using it as we walk through on page the task force assignment, which is on page 6. And you can look at the agenda. I mean, we're going to sort of feel our way through this to start with, because it's a rather broad charge, and sort of scope ourselves and see what it is people want to do. Obviously, as a context, we have a renewable energy standard, and the renewable energy standard requires the construction of a lot of wind facilities. We have a seabed law, which defines a certain type of project over which there's been some discussion, and we're focusing on that to a large extent. In the seabed law, there are off-ramps that allow the utilities to have their obligation modified or delayed if certain things happen, such as lack of transmission or too expensive. It's too expensive or it's not feasible. So I think we should be cognizant of that, and perhaps we'll distribute a copy of that law some future day. We don't want to overload you with paper, obviously, but they play together. It's because of the RES that there's a seabed, and to a large extent. So one is the son of the other. All right, so I'm thinking, I wonder if Bob has any thoughts. And Bob and Andy Pomeroy didn't introduce himself. He might want to introduce himself.
I'm Andy Pomeroy. I work for the House Energy Committee.
And Jenny Myers, sort of the four of us are the legislative staff. You want to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Jenny.
And to begin with, we'll be running the meetings. One of the topics on the agenda is hiring somebody. We have the LCC, which is our governing body, not the task force, but LCC, has approved $250,000 budget for a number of tasks, including this one. And we're thinking that there's probably some expertise needed with respect to the business modeling and the business transactions and what's good for the locals, what's better, what worse, how can we develop a model, and perhaps with respect to the property rights issue, which we may which is another assignment for the task force, which this group may be involved in. We're thinking at the current time, right, so we might have to hire some people. So part of the discussion will be how are we going to run this show? Our initial thought is the expert would probably not be running the meetings because we'd like to buffer that person, you know, and not put them in the middle of sort of that aspect of it, unless we hire somebody who is very capable of that and does a wonderful job. So to get the ball rolling, why don't we turn to the document. Any of you fellows have anything you want to add? Okay. Turn to page 6 of this document. And I think what we'll do is we'll just go through this, and then we'll go around this table and ask people what their vision of what they think we should be doing, what's lacking, what needs to be clarified. But let's get on it. Let's sort of go slow. Okay. First, Jenny is going to say a couple of things.
Okay. First of all, we're trying to get Dan Urano on the phone right now. He's going to join us via speakerphone. We're having some technical problems, so if things start beeping and Dan just suddenly appears, that's what's happening. Also, we're going to send around a sign-in sheet, so if everybody that's here on the task force would sign in, that would be helpful. So thank you. Okay, sorry. Thank you.
Okay, so if you turn to page 6.22, and I'm sorry if you all are well-versed, but I think it's good to get a solid grounding on what we've been told by statute to do, and then go from there. So the Electric Energy Task Force shall oversee and appoint an advisory task force. That's you folks, on community-based energy development. Okay. It lists who should be on it. Issues, subdivision 2. The task force shall study and make recommendations to the chairs and ranking minority members of the Senate and House of Representatives committees with primary jurisdiction over energy policy in a report submitted by January 15, 2008 on the following issues. I think that's a very tight deadline, January 15th, and just as I'll make a few editorial asides. I think there may be a reason to keep this going because this RES is in existence for a long time, and it's a dynamic situation. Because if you go to the end, you see we expire on that date as well. And I don't think that issue is going to expire on that date. So we'll see. And I don't think the expert's going to expire on that date. We're not going to hire an expert and say you're done on January 15th. Hopefully you can be, but it might not be done. We might not have a complete recommendation. I also don't envision that we vote in the sense that that we lobby each other. Basically, we bring information to the expert. We're an advisory group. Discuss it. You can certainly have input to the task force itself, but I don't see us taking votes, and that vote represents what the recommendation is going to be. I think the expert's going to be the person who basically synthesizes what you tell them, and you're free to tell them.
Sit on. Say hello.
Hello.
Okay, great. Nice to have you here, Dan.
Let's all say hi to Dan.
Hi, Dan.
Can you hear?
Yep, I heard you.
Okay, great. Statutory charge to the task force, okay?
Thank you. Yep. So subdivision 2, the task force shall study, and that's us, the advisory task force, and make recommendations to the chairs, and I'm John Fuller speaking, Dan, and ranking minority members of the Senate and House of Representatives committees, okay, on these issues. 1, the definition of a seabed qualifying owner. And what you'll see in this document is what I've done is I've put in what happened this year, just so you could get a context of sort of what happened this year and what we're working from. So that striking and underlying, it's like a bill. It represents the bill, the first 6 or 7 subdivisions of this document. Okay. So that's the first issue. Second issue is the definition of gross revenues with respect to community benefits. And that ties back into the definition of what's a qualifying project. The ability of Minnesota and non-Minnesota financial institutions to provide capital, compliance and enforcement, wind easements. And I believe that's an issue that could be tied into this issue of tying up property rights, which is a separate provision in the Senate File 145, which passed. There's a study that's mandated to look at whether there's a problem of developers warehousing property rights for wind development and not utilizing them. Thereby, the argument goes obstructing the development of certain properties for wind development. Feed-in tariffs for community energy. 7, community energy models project structure. 8, credits toward utility renewable energy standard requirements for utility participation. 9, utility compensation for additional work for community ownership projects. 10, types of incentives, compensation, and encouragement for utility participation. And 11, a catch-all, other topics related to and impacting the CBED program as determined by the task force. And then you'll notice that this group expires on January 16, 2008. My reaction to this, this was passed, is that it's not particularly a bullseye list of things. And it's, sometimes it's very, very overly specific or very specific, and sometimes it's overly broad. And so I think as a group, I think we're going to have to refine our charge under the authority of Clause 11 and sort of determine, you know, what it is we think is important. And I think stepping back, we have to examine the notion of why do we have CBED, what do we want from CBED, you know, what those sort of broader questions, and then dive into the details seem to come later to me. So I think we should understand, I mean, fundamentally what the legislature did, they said we want non-greenhouse gas emitting electric energy generation projects, and we're mandating them. So that's the first, we want to build them. Okay, if there wasn't that, there wouldn't be CBED. So first, our first goal is to build the stuff in the most intelligent, reliable, cost-effective way. That's the goal. And part of that, then CBED joins in on that. So what I'm going to ask is we go around the room, and people feel free to speak at length about what they think it would be of value for this group to look at as a subject and what they think this model or this idea is based on and what it's supposed to do, what we want from it. You know, and then we'll go from there. Then I think we'll talk about what sort of expert. But until we find out what it is people are thinking, I think we can't really proceed. So was it Karen Hyde? Mm-hmm. I think we'll just go around. And I would ask that there's go through me if you want to interrupt somebody, and people in the audience. You know, if there's a great level of frustration, maybe give us a note, or because we'll try to accommodate. Because I know you are knowledgeable because you're here. So we like to, you know, utilize your knowledge as well. But right now, we'll sit at the table, and I don't think I want people engaged in the debate at this point. People are speaking of their opinions, and then you can speak of your opinions, and then later on, we'll have a more of a give and take, maybe. So that's what I see. I just where you're at, what you think we should be doing, what this is all about, you know. What the legislature intended, what they should have intended with this notion. So, Karen, jump in. And this won't be your only chance. This won't foreclose it. But it will. We have to put out an RFP for the expert because we're a state agency. We're not nimble. So we have to go through some process. We have to publish. And so we really have to get going now because I think it'll take a couple of months to hire somebody. Okay? So we are going to be moving at a rapid state pace.
Sure.
I think we lost Dan.
That was a wise choice.
He said, I'm out of here.
Could I go call in?
We'll see if he calls back.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Ms. Hyde?
Okay. I think that the list is actually pretty good. I think it gets at, in a kind of maybe a little bit of a roundabout way, discussions around what the impediments are today to seabed projects. And I think that that's an important thing for us to discuss is what's either helping seabed projects come to fruition or what's stopping them.
So current impediments to seabed and
right.
Current, what would you call them, facilitators to seabed? Okay.
And I think that among that list, maybe some things that aren't quite spelled out on here would be interconnection queue issues. And then accessibility of turbines, I don't think is spelled out too clearly. I think probably a lot of it will come out in the definition of gross revenue section and the ability for financial institutes to provide capital. I think we'll see quite a bit come out in those sections that lead to either what's causing.
What was your first one? It was accessibility of turbines, and what was the other one?
Oh, interconnection queue.
Interconnection queues. Thank you. And why do you think we have CBED? I mean, what do you think the purpose of CBED is? What are we trying to do? And I'll ask everybody. I mean, just so we know, because then we can shape our discussion. What What do you fancy is the reason why we have this on the table now?
I think there's two.
Dan? Okay, sorry, I think we lost you. Okay.
I think there's two.
Karen primary. Hyde from Excel is talking about why she thinks we need CBED.
Is it loud enough for you?
Okay. I think there's two primary public policy objectives. One is to advance renewable generation in the state, and then perhaps more importantly, at least for why CBED's actually defined, would be to attempt to keep the economic benefits of generation in the local communities, specifically in the rural areas.
John?
I guess pretty broadly I agree with Karen that CBED is law in Minnesota because the legislature has a commitment to both renewable energy and rural economic development. And I guess my interest in how we end up is that CBED projects can compete on an equal footing with large projects, that the community benefits are in fact maximized, and that CBED projects provide a means for economic participation. And I guess by that I mean that ordinary folks, like most of us at the table, will have an opportunity to invest in either the equity or take on some of the CBED projects so that we can have a piece of a wind turbine ourselves.
When you say that they should be able to compete, what is your notion then that it would be a competition that if CBEDs were the best, they would get 100%, or if they were the worst, they could get 0%. You know, what is your sense when you say that they should be able to compete?
I think community scale projects. I'm not the only person who feels this way. Are working in a market where the large scale projects have an easier time putting all of the pre-development. Some people might argue would be a less than economical project.
All right. I think the pause means he's done.
My outlook of CBED is to inform and educate people about the possibilities for economic development.
Could you introduce yourself again?
Wade Gordon from Fond du Lac Tribal Community College. One thing that I've seen in the past is that there's a lot of misunderstanding about possible economic development through wind energy. And a lot of the tribes are expressing a sincere interest about pursuing large-scale utility wind power. And I know White Earth Reservation over by Fargo, North Dakota, they're looking at a large-scale wind turbine right now, and they're trying to find expertise and actually finance companies to come in and help pay for that. And there's a whole issue of sovereignty nations. I don't know if you're familiar with that or if this is the right venue to get into that, but a lot of finance companies will not go into that type of agreement because of legalities. And so they're looking at how we finance this. And I think a lot of it is, if we could write into this bill, a component about working with the tribes, because I know Grand Portage has expressed an interest too, and they're doing feasibility studies right now, and they've been doing it for the last 3 years in Mount Maud up by Grand Portage, that they're aggressively moving forward with a wind turbine. So I'd like to see a component of that written into the bill about working with the tribes, or have somebody that has the expertise in working with the tribes.
So you're saying that issues of sovereignty are hampering development on tribal
somewhat
lands.
I mean, there are definitely limitations because of legality and ownership, because of sovereignty. It's actually tribal reservations are nations inside of a state, inside of a nation. So there's this issue of, you know, who owns this if this thing does go south. That's, you know, so how do we handle that? And it's kind of this concept that Tribe of Wisconsin has developed a for-profit enterprise that is licensed through the state that they are their financial arm that does economic development. So this is a mechanism that we're looking at helping to get off the ground through our college to help be the catalyst to bring together the tribes and to unite and educate about the possibilities of exploring this venue. So,
From the business community's
perspective,
I'm sorry, Mike Franklin with the Minnesota Chamber. From the business community's perspective, I think it's evident to us now that the legislature has given us a pretty big task, and that's to find a way to meet 25% or 30 in some cases of our electricity by renewable energy by 2020. I think our priority for projects like Seabed is to make sure that they're able to provide a net economic development benefit to the state, and that's looking at both sides of the coin. That's looking at where the money is coming from and where it goes to, and making sure that the projects, I think I heard earlier, that are they're competitive with other projects. I think that's probably the best way to characterize our interest in making sure Seabed is successful. We want to make sure that the PUC has options in terms of and that there is some competition out there to meet the needs of the RES and of customers.
And what do you think this? What do you think the purpose of the Seabed Law was? What was the legislature trying to do when it sort of created this entity or acknowledged it?
Well, I think the to some extent, it seems to me that Seabed is something of an artifact of a pre-mandate environment. That Seabed was created in the 05 session, and the mandate was in the 07 session. And I think that, but I don't think that makes Seabed obsolete by any means. I think that Seabed now is competing against other projects that are seeking to fill a void. I think that the legislature has made it clear in 2005 and in 2007 that their preference is for the renewable energy projects to meet the mandate, that those come from Minnesota projects and to the extent possible and feasible from local smaller projects. So
I think you said something that's important and we should all reflect on, which is we have a dynamic statutory situation. And one of the reasons people are interested in the Seabed concept is that there's a potential that, who knows, maybe they'll get an absolute piece of pie, maybe it'll grow. There's that uncertainty which makes people nervous that if they're not identified as Seabed, they'll be shut out. And I think that drives a lot of the interest as well. And I don't know if I call it an artifact, but it was an entity or something that existed before the large-scale development was absolutely required. And I think you're right, that does require a couple things. One is to make sure that whatever we adopt as a Seabed concept doesn't interfere with and expedites the construction of these many number of windmills. But I think we have to keep aware there's that other issue, which is not only, I don't know how we're going to address this, but it's there. Okay, if you are Seabed, what does it mean? And that's a big deal, okay? And so we can't be ignorant of that. We should put it on the table, and because that drives a lot of people's interest, that if being Seabed means you get a big piece of the pie, they want to be Seabed. Okay. Go ahead, introduce yourself again, please.
Name's Andrew Falk. I'm an independent developer and Seabed advocate. I guess the reason I'm here is I want to make sure that we have the effective tools and policies in place to make sure that local people and communities can own the resources of which surround them. If renewable energy is going to save rural America or rural Minnesota, we want to make sure that we allow those people in the rural areas to have the opportunities to own the resources and benefit from them.
You weren't here when we introduced ourselves, were you? Did you just come?
I got stuck up in traffic.
I'll give you a little context. We went through the statutory charge, and one of the questions we're asking people, and maybe they're satisfied because we have this catch-all, which is, do you think this list is an adequate list? It needs clarification, things need to be added. And then the other question was, you know, what your thoughts are on this whole topic, what do you think we should be doing, and also why do you think there's Seabed, what was the policy reason, and you expressed that.
Yep.
But anyway, that's nobody so far has said, I think, well, accessibility of turbines and interconnection has been mentioned, but think hard about that, because we're a state entity. We move fast and we move slow, but we're going to develop the concepts fast, you know. George, introduce yourself, please. And
thank you. George Crocker, North American Water Office, Seabed. The reason I think we have CBED, and I think we need to remember that CBED came before any objective or mandate was put in place. So there was a commitment to do community-based energy, and the reason that we were committed to do it was because of its environmental benefits. And the fact is, if we're going to do enough renewable energy to make any difference at all environmentally, we're going to need a whole lot of it, and we're going to need it quite quickly. And if we're going to do that, why we can't treat the communities that are impacted by that development as colonies. They have to have the wealth. They have to have a good share of the wealth that is generated by our commitment, by our public commitment to renewable energy, and by our ratepayers paying for the infrastructure required to bring that renewable energy online. If we're going to make that commitment, if that commitment is going to stick, and if we're going to do enough in time to make a difference environmentally, we're going to have that local economic development in spades circulating through the local communities. Otherwise, it's just going to be a fight. So going through your list, I mean, that's sort of why we have CBED in my view. Going through your list, the definition of CBED, I think, is a really, really important thing. And, John, I think you got to the crux of it when you talked about priority. I think that we need to focus on a spectrum of ownership models. This is one of the things that did come up through the legislative discussion this past session. CBED is sort of, in my opinion, at the top, where the maximum amount of economic development and wealth generated by our commitment to renewable energy stays within the Minnesota community. Sort of at the bottom of that spectrum would be just a straight-out bid project in which most of the money that is generated by our commitment to renewable energy and our paying for the infrastructure goes to outside interests, for example, an Exco or Florida Power and Light. In between, there's a whole spectrum of opportunity. We have various revenue sharing models. I think the challenge for this task force is to understand that spectrum of ownership models and where the revenues flow in each of those and prioritize those in terms of what the utilities are expected to do as they move to meet their obligations under the renewable energy mandate. And I think once we have that kind of a framework established, a lot of the rest of it will flow. And in doing that, I think that will help us get towards this definition of gross revenue, which actually I think we did a really good job of in the past session, of coming to an understanding of how to measure that, of giving the Department of Commerce the tools that they need to measure that without being absolutely specific or explicit in a arbitrary judgment.
Could you explain how they're to measure that under the law?
Essentially, it was Mike probably remembers it better than I do, but it was to enable the maximum amount for the department to make a judgment on the maximum amount that is flowing through based on, well, actually, we should just find the language rather than.
I mean, I don't want to be tricky, but, George, I've heard the contrary. I've heard that there is some confusion about what the revenue requirement is. So that's why I asked you. So there might be a difference of opinion. I don't have an opinion. I've heard that opinion.
There's a judgment that's required. At least, is this the
50,
yeah. At least 51% of the gross revenue.
He's looking at page 2.9 of this document.
Yeah, 2.8, 2.9. Demonstrates at least 51% of the gross revenues from a power purchase agreement over the life of the project will flow to qualifying owners and other local entities, which allows judgment on the part of the Department of Commerce to understand what are other local entities that would qualify for being a portion of that 51%. So, in other words, this is not an exact thing where you can hold up a measuring the same measuring stick for one project and apply it to another, because maybe it's that there's a construction firm just across the border in Dakota that is doing a really good job and has Minnesota employees working for it. Well, does that count? Well, maybe it should. Maybe there's another project that has a Minnesota office, but it hires a workforce that's a corporate workforce that goes gallivanting all over the globe doing stuff. Well, does the fact that they have a Minnesota office make them qualify? Well, the Department of Commerce now has the flexibility and the ability under statute to make that judgment. Moving on to, I think that the other point that I really want to make has to do with the infrastructure requirements, and it's been referred to several times with the transmission issues, with what Karen Hyde said about interconnection issues. I think that this task force needs to be really mindful of the infrastructure costs that we are incurring. We did pass, in part of this legislation, the transmission, the dispersed generation transmission analysis. And I think that we need to keep a really open mind about what kind of opportunity do we get to with the alternative paradigm, essentially, that CBED represents. If the old paradigm of delivering electric utility services is remote generator hooked up to distant load over high voltage power line, which is what we know how to do quite well, the CBED paradigm is figuring out how to serve those same loads and growing loads instead by collecting, effectively and efficiently collecting energy from multiple distributed and dispersed generation sources. It's a different type of development, and it offers some real huge economic advantages over the old paradigm. And I think when we're talking about being competitive, if that's a benchmark for what is CBED, why then you absolutely have to include those kinds of infrastructure costs in your calculus for what is competitive and what is not.
I think George raised a number of good points. There's a number of tensions. I mean, one of the obvious tensions is how do you develop a model? The statute's pretty inflexible. We put numbers in there. So what if everybody in the community has supported a 50.9% revenue? It turns out that's what it is. And utilities love it. The local community loves it. The risk is right. It works for everybody. It looks like CBED, and it's not CBED because we have a rule that says you have to have this amount. So the tension is between obviously being overly prescriptive and shutting out projects that, they're pretty CBED-y. They meet the objective of the intent of a CBED law. And so that's one of the tensions we're dealing with in trying to move forward on this. So, Michael?
CBED-y. I like that. Our support for...
Just identify yourself for Dan.
Hi, Dan. This is Mike Wolf from the Department of Commerce. I should also say that here also from the department is Jeremy DeFevre and Lisa Trudeau somewhere. They're part of the CBED team, folks that I rely on when we work on CBED projects. And if we have additional meetings, they may be called on to sit here instead of me. They have some additional expertise that you might find useful rather than my blathering. But I guess from our overall perspective, our commitment to community-based energy development, it predates the RES. It predates the CBED law. If you recall, CBED, we working in a coalition of folks, brought CBED to the legislature in 2005 because the REPI, the Renewable Energy Production Incentive Program, which promoted community-based energy development prior to 2005, we ran out of money. We were in a budget deficit, and the amount of money that we could commit to that penny and a half or penny subsidy that was provided to those projects, we couldn't find the cash for additional projects. We had to find a different model, and we came up with this CBED model and fit it within the REO at the time. But I'd say also our commitment predates that in Minnesota, our experience with ownership and benefit, local ownership and local benefit from energy production stems from our experience with the farmer-owned cooperative ethanol plants, which have acted over the past 10, 15 years as economic anchors, capturing energy dollars to local economies, acting as economic anchors for those rural economies, and allowing those dollars to be reinvested again and again. So this is a broader scope, both in terms of our commitment to
community energy is broader than the seabed law itself. It goes and extends to other energy areas of energy production, both in terms of, so it's broader in scope, both in terms of the time that we've been, that Minnesota has been committed to community energy and the scope of energy production. The seabed law itself, you know, it's a fairly simple idea. You want to capture benefits to local economies. You want to provide ratepayer value. So as a general rule, the projects need to be competitive. There's negotiation, so it keeps the rates in a competitive ballpark. And we're looking to make sure the projects are financeable and can go forward, so that they can get turbines and projects can get up and running. But that simple concept, you know, when you overlay it across this very complex industry, makes this very hard. And I'm very happy to have you sitting there, John, instead of me, because I think this has been something we've all been struggling with for a couple of years now. And I think every time we get together to talk through this, my sense is we get better, a better understanding of what we can do. So I think that this could be a very good exercise on our investment of all of our times. But I'm thankful you're there and I'm not.
I mean, there's a number of tensions, you know, between if you have a utility system that traditionally owns its assets and they own their coal plants, and then there's going to be a different model and they're going to buy everything through purchase, then there's obviously a supply risk for them at some point in time as these contracts expire and they don't know, they have to renegotiate. So there's all these. It strikes me one of the things we're going to have to do is have a lot of discussions between those folks who are, and we can have at this table maybe, you know, what are Otter Tail's problems with this? You know, what are their needs? What are their concerns? How can that fit in with you know, we want to build things cheaply, nimbly, efficiently, and then how does seabed, you know, how do we fit that in there as neatly as possible? You know, so yeah. I think.
Yeah, I think I'd echo that, and there's been a tremendous amount of creativity just from the folks around this table to try to make these projects work. You know, from Karen working on the contracting, on the utility side, making it work for her ratepayers and her company, and Todd Vilnosky from John Deere as a equity provider and turbine supplier have been very creative in trying to make this work for their company, and then the developers around the table working. You know, God bless them. It's hard work. This is a very hard thing to do to make these projects cash flow and get up and running. So, you know, Paul White, I'm sitting. There's a bunch of folks. There's a bunch of expertise and a bunch of creativity sitting here. And I think, and Dan Urano on the phone has been working on all sides of these projects and seeing the various tensions that everybody brings to the table and trying sitting as a negotiator and working through the legal concepts. I think. Will benefit greatly from his expertise as well.
Hi, I'm Paul Blackburn from Windustry. And, well, what they said, there's a lot of commonality here. I want to run through a few things, but I think that the theme I'd like to suggest that we need to all think about is the theme of time. We're at a pretty unique opportunity in history with this resource. And if folks understand the history of natural resource development in the United States and even before then, understand that these kinds of opportunities come up very rarely. And so when you said it's hard work, it is hard work, but it's worth it. And the legislature has some hard work, but I think it'll be worth it for the legislature to do this hard work. The things that come up for me are, and Windustry, are a long-term rural economic development that will spill over for the rest of the state, advancing environmental goals to reduce greenhouse emissions and other pollutants over the long term, energy security over the long term, and to facilitate long-term stable growth of the industry itself. And all those things have to do with time. The, you know, we can talk about economic development in the near term, but if we look at the history of land development in Minnesota versus other parts of the country, if we look at natural resource development in Minnesota versus the rest of the country or even overseas, there is no guarantee that a wealth of natural resource will result in local wealth to the people who live there. There are plenty of examples for the local. There's tremendous resources locally, and yet the local people are poor. So it's very important. And this is, as we said, the only resource that's similar to this is water. And it took hundreds of years, we all know, who've looked at any kind of water resource history, to develop the dams, to develop the rules about how to get hydropower. Well, you know, we have the ability, I think, in this room to look at what has been done previously and understand how to develop this resource appropriately, because, man, if it's messed up, it could get really messed up. And if you look at the history, for example, mineral rights law in Minnesota, things can get pretty bollocked up with how mineral rights were assigned originally. So, you know, again, this is really important work. I think we all understand that. The goals are very similar: economic development, security, helping Minnesotans have a better quality of life. But it's going to take work on our part. It's going to take forethought, and it's going to take looking out not just for the 20 years or 30 years of a PPA, not just for how long, similar to what the utility folks used to listening to or to thinking about in a 50-year lifespan or whatever of a coal plant. This is a perpetual resource. Things that we decide this year or the next few years could very much affect not just decades but centuries for how this energy is worked and how Minnesota's rural communities survive. So that's what I'd like to add to the theme is the sense of time and the importance of this issue. Thanks.
I think one thing we have to keep in mind is that the RES is driving this. And, of course, we pick, and it was a very sensitive issue. It's been a sense, you know, how much you have to do, and it's been a fight. And it's cast in concrete now. And one of the things that the legislature doesn't want to do is do harm. And so I think in the back of people's mind there should be some thought about the willingness to that if in 2011 or 2012 it looks like a number is off and it should be moved back or moved forward so that the utilities can do something that's intelligent rather than have to meet an arbitrary, well, it's arbitrary, a number that's there if, in fact, there's a new turbine coming down or transmission is going to come up here later. I think in the back of our mind we have to have some notion that that law shouldn't be seen as something that's absolutely concrete if the parties can agree on that it makes sense that there's some change to it, the schedule or whatever, increase, decrease, speed it up, slow down, because that's a concern that we have. That, you know, we did put in absolute numbers, but it may be that, I mean, it was a crystal ball. They probably are not the right numbers. They may work though. So, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Jay Alsop, and I'm with Outland Renewable Energy in the development area.
How do you spell your last name, Jay?
A L L S U P.
Thank you.
I think that, as a developer, I think CBED enforces us to be good corporate citizens in Minnesota. And I think that CBED creates a role which is pretty unique, I think, if you look at it from the upper Midwest, and really forcing the way we look at the development, the way we look at our models to really appreciate the landowner and making sure that both the control is in the hands of the landowner as well as a substantial amount of the economic interest goes to the landowner. I think I'm here today a little bit to kind of, you know, put a few challenges around what, you know, the definition of gross revenues are, what the definitions of what a landowner ownership really means right now, and to do it in such a way that we can be economically competitive with maybe a larger scale project right now that'll still keep the tenets of the landowner ownership model as the core probability, but we'll bring the economics that will allow us to look at maybe some unique opportunities on a larger 100 to 120 megawatt type projects and look at that definition a little more closely and talk a little bit about, the quality of the capital in Minnesota and the quality of the capital from, you know, outside of Minnesota and really what that means to some of these projects and some of the economics. And with the understanding that at the end that, you know, we would like to have CBED be a major piece of the RES initiative, not a minor piece, and create the economics that will allow that to happen at this point. And I want to echo, I think, a couple of sentiments from Karen, and that is that really, for our perspective, too, is, you know, we interface with a lot of different governmental agencies, and one of the principal ones in Minnesota is MISO. And I think there's a lot of challenges right now as we look at building a massive amount of infrastructure transmission. George talked about it as well, is how we develop a cost allocation system or how we work with the transmission aspects to really create a fairness or fair play relative to how we allocate that infrastructure upgrade both through the utilities and through the generator system at this point. So look forward to an interesting session.
And don't forget, if you have ideas that you think should be put on the table that aren't articulated in the statute, tell us. And if you have a sense of what you think CBED was intended to do, because that should drive our our details. Don't be shy to mention them. Go ahead.
Todd Volnosky with John Deere.
How do you spell your last name, Todd?
Well, my family spells it V as in Victor, E-L-N-O-S-K-Y. Other people, like the telemarketers and such, spell it differently. Occasion, including my utility company, who's not represented here, by the way. I don't know that I have anything to add additionally to what's been said on the intent of CBED and the goal of CBED. I think it's been fairly well articulated. I think the and it may be an undertone in what's here, but it's not specifically stated. From our perspective, and we've had an opportunity to view a good number of projects in Minnesota that have been striving to be CBED, and we've seen a pretty phenomenal market change over the last 18 months or 2 years in the sort of economic viability of certain projects. And it's not the inherent nature of the project itself which drives it, but it's a lot of market dynamic out there which puts pressure on projects that they didn't have back when they either filed their RFP for their PPA or really started the development. Turbine prices, and I think many people have probably read the Wall Street Journal article from earlier in the week that was simply discussing turbine scarcity and also turbine prices and the fact that you've got critical component suppliers out there for these manufacturers which aren't able to make their deadlines, which lowers the overall supply in the marketplace as a natural increase in cost. Also, with the demand for wind out there, and I think it's proper for Minnesota to be addressing this, we have supply chain issues, most notably cranes. They're hard to get. You can get them, but they do take an awful lot of oomph to get them and to get them on a time frame and that's going to work for both your power purchase agreement, your interconnection agreement, and any other obligations you may have. Lastly, what we've seen is just because of the rapid increase in these costs, power purchase rates haven't risen at the same rate that the overall sort of niche wind market, that inflation rate's been at. So we've seen a lot of challenges. From our perspective, I think what we need to do, and I think John pointed out well, is the projects that we're looking at, they need to be competitive in the overall marketplace. I think not only not only to be good for Minnesota, but also make sure that you attract capital to come at these projects, because you want to make sure that you've got a decent amount of volume in this space. And is this on?
Yeah, but the phone isn't connected to the mics.
Ah.
We can hear you. Can you hear us?
Do we is there a little remote mic that we need to move around?
Can you
around?
Hear us now, Dan?
Thank you.
No.
Can you hear Todd?
Dan, can you hear me?
I think there's a little green light right here that I pushed a little while ago, and it went red because I didn't
George,
want anybody.
George, stop playing with the telephone.
But I was thinking.
Green, George.
And now it's green.
Okay.
Because I pushed it again.
Also, Todd's a little bit farther away from that microphone over there, so. Yeah. Why doesn't Todd finish up and then, Dan, you can give us your thoughts, and then we can continue on so you can get on your way. How's that? Okay.
Well, I, you know, in short, because many good things have been said, we just need to make sure that the space stays competitive. And then also, I think our charge is, I'm going to oversimplify our charge. Our charge is to make it work. We've got a lot of the right parties here around the table, and any wind project, big or small, is a partnership between a whole variety of folks, anywhere from the people that dig the trenches for the cabling, for the collector system, all the way to the power purchase agreement with the utility. It can't work without all those pieces fitting together. And I think we've got good representation here, and our goal is to see how do we strengthen the partnership through our work in this committee, and then also understanding the various viewpoints, so that CBED isn't just competitive or not just modeled for today, but you also consider CBED for tomorrow, 5 years out, 10 years out, because that's the bigger challenge.
Go ahead, Dan.
some that you can do, wow, this, you know, this ownership model is adds a lot of merit in a sense of local benefits, where at the same time it's not creating so much risk for the owners. And the risk reward model is something that I always keep in mind when I counsel my clients. That's something that's paramount to their investment decision in any way or not. So I think it'd be important for us to look at the diverse model and see if we can incorporate them into the CBED statute. I think that this probably the bigger part of my comment. I think also there was something that John, just a couple of things that
Thank you, Dan. Is he disconnected? A couple of thoughts before we move on. One is I have a homework assignment because it becomes clear you're all very knowledgeable. I'd like you, we have an email site, right? Is it through Andy? How are we communicating with? Yeah. I want you to list what you think are important things to consider from your perspective. Like, for example, from the utility perspective, how do we get this done in the time frame? You know, how are we comfortable not owning our generation? So basically, we see all the concerns because, and then see if we can accommodate our seabed model to address those concerns to the greatest extent possible. So, from the seabed folks, you know, how do I get turbines? How do I get financing? Just an absolute list with maybe a sentence narrative of what it means if it's a little Delphic. Don't speak in code. And then what Todd said is pretty clear, and Dan articulated too, is that we have a dynamic market. And so we have to have a model that responds to the change in markets if, in fact, at some juncture, I mean, maybe you don't do it or you do it, which is another reason maybe to make the standards more flexible because it might be a bad time to do it, just a window. But do we want to have a model that says, well, when there's a supply scarcity, you know, we can accommodate that. We certainly want to be able to accommodate different markets or change the law to accommodate the fact that it's not a good market sometimes, you know. And so I think we have to be concerned about that. So anyway, that's the homework assignment. I think that will be helpful to get that in writing, make a list we can circulate. By the way, whatever you give us, we share. So if you have something that you're not comfortable with sharing, that's all right too, but tell us that. You know, if there's something that, it's, you know, that's of a nature that, you know, it's appropriate not to. Go ahead.
Just to make that logistically work, why don't people email those comments to me or Andy or both of us, and we'll compile a list and then send that out to the listserv so that there's not, like, 25 emails shooting around to everybody all the time. I think that would probably work best.
And so the thought is, you know, what are the issues out there that people are working with this project should be aware of? You know, what should be aware of people's concerns as we develop recommendations to the task force and the legislature? So let's continue. Introduce yourself and.
Oh. Is this one on? I didn't know. I get two microphones.
You speak out of both sides of your mouth.
Okay. I'm Beth Soholt with Wind on the Wires. First of all, I just wanted to give a one-second background on Wind on the Wires. We have 23 members right now, and not that everybody isn't important, but I wanted to highlight for this group some of the folks who are sitting in this room and who are also maybe people don't know are involved in Wind on the Wires. Fredrickson and Byron is a member. John Deere is a member. Midwest Wind Finance. The Ron Group, which is doing a lot of community wind. Suzlon, who's working with Seabed Projects a lot, and Windustry. So we have a real mix of corporate and community wind folks and people who supply goods and services to the industry. So that's just a little bit of background. Some of the themes that I think are important for this work group are flexibility in the definition and in how this is going to go forward. One of the things I don't think has been either explicitly recognized in the statute or worked on enough is the partnerships that could happen between the corporate developers and the community wind developers. There's really a lot of synergies that could happen between those types of developers. Now, it has to work for either party, but we've always talked about being able to share substation capacity or turbine orders or, you know, interconnection costs or a whole variety of other things. And we haven't spent a lot of time, I think, developing those kinds of partnerships. I think it's an education process between the corporate developers and the community wind developers and how those might work. And I think it's not different than anything other else that we've done. Once we have some of those that have really taken place, becomes a model for other things to happen. I think we're concerned about the cost of projects remaining competitive. And I would like to ditto the work on the supply chain issues. If you talk to a Clipper or a Suzlon or a turbine manufacturer that's chosen to locate in a certain state, after they've made their location decision, the next thing that they really care about is component parts. You know, is there going to be a foundry or a, you know, a bolt supplier or something that can be located right next to them so they have parts to be able to do their turbines? Wind easements, an issue that's had a lot of debate on the very closing days of the session. I think one of the concerns we have on the wind easement, and I think we'd like to get more testimony from not just the advocates who may have positions on the wind easement issue, but really from developers who are doing projects. I think the only testimony the committee heard was from NXCO on their timeline on their Fenton project. And then we got the wind easement issue put in statute. And I think the committee and the legislature as a whole needs more education on what's the process that developers go through to actually, you know, and how does that wind easement issue play in the developing of their projects? I agree we need more financing representation in the committee. If Edison or, you know, somebody else that's financing CBIT community wind projects could be a part of this, that would be good. And then I think the last thing that I have is I think this task force and the legislature really need to struggle with the intersection between the ideology of CBED and how projects actually get put together. There's a reality about how projects actually have to happen, and we can't be so wedded to it has to be this one ideological way when there's a reality about the process of projects, that the how they get financed, how they get developed, how they get purchased by utilities, you know, what really happens. And so I think that's an education process, too, for people, and people are learning a lot more about that. But there's got to be a balance between the perfect and the good. And so those are my thoughts.
Thank you. Whoever is the next member.
Maybe right.
I'll take it. Is this on? Yeah. Good morning. I'm Glenn Skarbaka with Great River Energy. I came in a moment late, so I missed the initial round of introductions here. I manage resource planning at Great River Energy, which means that I'm the guy at GRE who has the renewable energy standard on his wall and stares at it every morning and tries to contemplate how in the world am I going to meet that. It's an interesting challenge and one to look forward to trying to meet. GRE, just for background, is a generation and transmission cooperative. It is owned by 28 distribution cooperatives, most of which are in the state of Minnesota. My role within GRE is kind of as a load aggregator. I'm not responsible for building generators or for building transmission, but I'm responsible for looking at the collective needs of the cooperative members that we serve and coming up with resources to meet their energy needs. And the metrics we use to meet those needs are primarily reliability and cost effectiveness, as well as environmental stewardship. But since we're talking about different types of wind here, I'm going to assume for the moment that seabed or non-seabed wind projects are comparable from an environmental standpoint. And when I look at reliability, I'm really concerned about not the short term, really concerned about meeting our long-term needs and making sure that partners that we get involved with are going to be there for the long term and that the resources we acquire are ones that our members can count on for long periods of time, you know, decades, if not more. And you know, a concern we have in achieving that long-term viability of projects is this is a very dynamic business that we're in wind. You've gotten a lot of flavor of that here already this morning. And we think one way to achieve long-term reliability in a time of uncertainty and rapid change is to make sure that we've got a diverse set of supplies. So diversity to us means having a diverse set of suppliers, a diverse set of resource locations, and a diverse set of business models, because I think at this stage we're not sure which business models are really going to prevail in the long term in this business. Cost effectiveness is very important to us, and when you look at cost effectiveness, again, we have long-term issues there. You know, a project that looks good for 5 years and craps out after 10 is not cost effectiveness in our measure. So long-term financial viability is important, and the cost of transmission is an important factor in that as well. We do recognize that we're talking about a holistic viewpoint of the cost of resources, and a resource that's cheap at the bus bar but expensive when it's delivered to the customers it's intended to serve is not necessarily a cheap project overall. So we are sensitive to that issue. One other thing we wrestle with in dealing with all resources, but particularly wind and particularly seabed, gets to be balancing the interests of our members, those who are participating in the direct benefits of projects, maybe those who are involved in a project or living in the communities that are seeing the most direct benefits from the addition of a project, versus our other members who are paying the cost for the resource but maybe not seeing as direct. Directly, the benefits that would come from being located in the community. I don't know what the answer to it is, but it is just something that I struggle with a bit, and I'm always looking for different viewpoints and guidance on. One piece of information to throw out, I'm not sure what to make of it, but I'll throw it out here for the good of our consideration, is that we've recently gone to the marketplace and solicited our next round of proposals for wind resources. And we got a very strong response from the marketplace, several thousand megawatts of new proposals coming to us. And I thought it was interesting. I haven't added up the exact numbers here, but it looked to me that at least two-thirds of those proposals were at least self-described as being seabed. So there is a lot of interest in seabed development out there, and there are a lot of folks who are you know, attempting to put seabed projects together. Now, the difficulty in any project is making sure that the project really can come up with the equipment, the turbines, the other supply items that we've talked about a little bit this morning, that they actually do have, can get the transmission access that they need, and lastly, that they've got the capital, to actually pull off the proposals that they've made to us. So there is a vibrant supply community out there. We're very encouraged to see that, and I guess our interest in this is to make sure that what comes out of our activity here enhances the viability of seabed and enhances the competitiveness of that supply community, and does not inadvertently somehow shackle some other players in the marketplace in trying to achieve our goals. One other puzzling thing I throw out as a question, because I don't know the answer to this, and maybe haven't been involved in this activity long enough, but I sense that there is an issue about seabed and the nature of the ownership that goes with it, but then I get a little confused sometimes about a thread relating almost to the size of the project, because there's large seabed and there's small seabed, and there's large non-seabed and small non-seabed as well, and so far I'm not so sure I see on my end where seabed is the determining factor in the competitiveness of the project. It may have more to do with economies of scale and so forth. But again, I don't have answers to that. I'm more interested in seeing where we go collectively trying to address some of that.
Glenn, that was recognized a couple of years ago, and I think George and others understood that seabed was not going to be defined by the size of the project. And so it's not, in general, a factor that goes into that definition. You're right. You can have any size seabed. It's not a statutory measurement of whether or not it's a seabed project. I think that was 2005. Yeah. Well, whoever's next.
Yeah. Brian Wolf with Wolfman Development. We developed a 5.25 megawatt project in Southwest Minnesota. Year and a half ago or so. We made use of the state incentive that Michael had talked about before, with the generous funding from Xcel Energy's renewable development fund there.
So you're REPI?
Yep.
Okay.
It was a REPI project. Looking at trying to develop seabed projects and trying to take the intent of the law here is to guarantee or maximize local returns with the seabed law to the community in which these projects are located. And when we're trying to do that, we've noticed that there can be some, we don't want any hindrances from the law, from different model types that we're looking at using. as a younger man, it makes some more sense for me to invest in a wind project and a flip model, and I'm more willing to take some risks when I'm 37. But when we're talking to some of the landowners that we work with and they're 55 years old, they don't want to take a lot of risk when they're 65 owning, operating wind turbines. And I guess the thing that I'd like to say is that we need that both the risk and the reward needs to be evaluated in these projects, because, yes, there is more reward with some, but sometimes it's not really worth the extra risk for the people we're trying to do them for. So
you think a model should accommodate, there's a class of people out there who are only willing, who are more risk adverse. And so for them, this is a question. For them, the model, there should be a model available that allows for lesser to go to those folks, because
just that the language would be flexible enough that somebody can make a determination that the risk and reward for this model is really about the same as the risk and reward for that model.
So it's not necessary. This is a question. You're not necessary. So you're thinking it's not necessarily the percentage of revenue, but it's the percentage of revenue given the level of investment and risk exposure that perhaps could be a part of the world of seabed.
It's something that we didn't take into consideration when we're talking about investing in these projects. So I think it needs to be something that whoever determines whether the project is seabed or not should probably evaluate also.
So when you do your homework, and you're thinking about what your concerns, not only your concerns, but your vision, things that should be considered, really broad-ranging, what what an intelligent person who's running this endeavor should have before them, from your viewpoint, as they consider what seabed should be. So that's what we want from you. Really, really your thoughts. Were you done?
Yep.
Thank you.
I'm Paul White. Paul White of Project Resources Corporation, Minnesota.
Paul, can you just pull that microphone? I think it might swivel around for you.
How about this one?
Either one.
I'm Paul White with Project Resources Corporation, Minnesota Wind Energy Company. And I have the benefit of having been in Minnesota in the early 90s and late 80s when the industry was getting started. So maybe talk a little more on big picture. And I really appreciate the reference to big picture and the invitation to talk about big picture, specifically because last time we had an EETF that I was involved in, it seemed that when we got to the conclusions and the report, there was a call for, well, we need a policy. We need some direction on the big picture before we get into all these details.
Enough said, Paul.
All right.
It didn't happen.
So, you know, if we can accomplish some big picture conclusions and consensus around seabed, man, that, you know, that would be a huge step forward in my view. But, you know, my view of this is that since the early 90s, we've been, you know, seabed is sort of analogous or part of that. We've been sort of admiring the Danish model for wind development that is based on feed tariffs, where, you know, they grew the wind industry in Denmark based on offering a percentage of retail rates for farmer-owned wind projects, and the whole industry was based on that, and it was successful, and we've always sort of envied that here, and we got the policies in place and some mandates, and believe it or not, we almost wound up with an industry in Minnesota that was utility-owned in the early 90s, I think 92. Xcel was, you know, a hair away from owning the first project, and there was a sort of a hiccup and some pressure, and it went into an IPP mode. So the IPP model, the independent power producer sort of foreign developer model, sort of came out of that event in 1992 with the first 25 megawatt project owned by Kennetec, and it's been here ever since. It's been, you know, the model for wind development around the country, and that's beginning to shift now back toward utility ownership since the utilities have got their books in order after deregulation and the Enron-type problems. The utilities have got their books in order, and they're looking for bricks-and-mortar investment. So the utilities are coming into wind heavy, and that will be the new challenge, is competing with, do we have seabed, or is it going to be utility-owned? But where we sit today is that this industry in Minnesota is IPP. There's this engine for wind development around the country and in Minnesota that has created manufacturing capacity. It's got the MISO and the interconnect process fairly well organized so that it works for wind development. And it's all IPP driven, largely. And we've struggled to have a Danish wind model or something come out of seabed or all the other policies. We've struggled to get in place to create this local loan model, and it just hasn't worked. We've been struggling with it. And we're always fighting against, basically, as far as I can see, we're not competitive. We're always struggling with being competitive either for the ratepayers or the skills aren't there in the community. And I don't have a magic answer for this, but some of the things that, you know, when you ask the question, how do we make seabed competitive? That's what I keep thinking about. How do we make locally owned projects competitive so they can play in the market and the ratepayer advocates won't undermine it and the utilities will be able to embrace it? And a couple of things that come to mind are that I think the, you know, aggregation of financing, I know there's work going on that now, but it seems we need the economies of scale that Glenn's talking about. And we need to get, you know, beyond the small is beautiful model for community ownership. We need to maybe have people focused on aggregating farmer investment into participating in projects that are larger and that leverage more substantial technical expertise to get projects done that don't ratchet up costs on ratepayers. There was, I think, in the legislation, there was some funding for a technical desk or some kind of support for technical support for wind energy.
That was in the spending bill, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that that's a fantastic idea, and that should be carefully thought through, and not, you know, hopefully that won't just go to something that doesn't have a big impact. That could be extremely helpful for helping folks aggregate financing or helping folks think outside the box on how they interconnect, how they can collaborate with other developers or other folks, utilities potentially. The third area is that I think is maybe can be promising to help make seabed competitive is somebody mentioned, I think Beth mentioned the collaboration with the IPPs or the wind developers. That's an area that I keep scratching my head, that why are we not sitting around a table with IPPs and with utilities and seabed, you know, leadership of the sort of seabed movement, you know, brainstorming and...
We are, Paul.
Okay, there's some of that going
That's
on.
That's where we're...
There's some of that going on, and I've been involved in much of it. I've tried along the edges along the way. What I've heard from, you know, folks is that IPPs don't want to share, and they just don't want to play in that game. But my experience is a little different, is that the IPPs, they want to be in the wind industry long term, and they're willing to have those conversations, and they're willing to be inventive and creative about it. I think that utilities have to be in the room too, because there is this move toward, you know, bricks and mortar investment.
Well, I was just suggesting that that's what this task force is.
Oh, they were right here.
They were
yeah.
right here.
Yeah, well, so, you know, that's my closing point, yep. is that I'm so glad that we're all here. I got it. So I think, you know, in my mind, we're always struggling to compete on the rate for ratepayer benefits, and we have to find ways to make seabed competitive for the ratepayers. Otherwise, we're always struggling against the economic measure that is pretty standard in the utility industry. And I just one note that I share the concern brought up on the wind rights and the perpetual wind rights. And my experience with wind rights, that I think we'll get into this deeper, but I'm very interested in learning more about what the standard is today for wind rights. I know that perpetual wind rights were kind of the standard in the early 90s that was used, and that I thought that that had all but gone away. I thought that all the developers of wind had moved to a model that was, you know, project-based, that they do a project and then the wind rights expire and then they have to renegotiate with farmers. So if perpetual wind rights, I don't think is good for anybody, because it is it's forever, and that definitely needs some scrutiny. So I guess with that, I'll say I'm glad we're all here, and I hope that, you know, thinking outside the box, I think, instead of, you know, trying to force things, how can we work with what the opportunities and the energies and the assets that are there to get where we need to be, as opposed to just, you know, putting forces against each other.
Thank you.
John, just before we, John, just one point that Paul raised the rural wind technical assistance, that appropriation, the RFP for that is out now. And if there's anybody that's interested in it, let me know. Or I could send it to Andy and Jenny, and they could send it out to the group if they're
interested. Is that through the Center for Rural Policy?
That's right.
Yeah, okay, that's one. Okay.
John, I'm Duane Ninneman. I'm an independent consultant from Ortonville, and
how do you
work
spell your last name?
Ninneman. I work primarily with Clean Up the River Environment in Montevideo. I think most of the issues that I'm concerned about have been covered by other members, but the most important thing that's been said here today was said by Mike Bull, and that's the issue of capturing energy dollars for local economies and maximizing that benefit. thereby sustaining rural communities. That's my primary interest in being here. It seems to me that in order to implement the RES, the rural landscape is dramatically going to change with the proliferation of wind turbines and other energy structures in rural Minnesota. Most rural residents, with that in mind, are saying, how do I get a piece of that? But there are other rural residents who are probably going to say, we don't want that in my backyard either. Keeping in mind the development in Denmark, the phrase that is often used is, your own pigs don't stink. And that's the importance of seabed, is that if the ownership opportunities for the farmers and the people who live on the landscape are shared with them, they're going to make sure that that development is allowed in that landscape. Part of the success of the RES and seabed is to also be sure that the tools and information from what is a very complex opportunity are successfully transferred to those rural stakeholders. And I think Mike Bull touched on that just a moment ago also, that the work that I do with municipalities, school districts, other people who are interested in becoming involved in seabed projects is very much a start at the bottom 101 education process about what it takes to become involved, to share the wealth. And certainly much of that is driven by the state policy, and there's generally a lack of understanding what state policy is amongst municipal and county and individual stakeholders in western and rural Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, Jim Nichols from the Buffalo Ridge Farmer. Very quickly, I have some specific proposals, but I don't want to put those on now. Let's face it, 90% of the turbines in this state are owned by three and foreign corporations and one Florida company. That's what we're up against. And the legislature couldn't figure out what to do, so they appointed a committee. That's why we're here. And we have to address that issue. That's one of the main reasons why we're here. Legislators, we were good at appointing committees when we couldn't come up with solutions. We contrast that, and Mike said it fairly well, the ethanol industry, 14 of the 15 plants are owned by farmers, and we planned that and grew that industry. Unfortunately, there was a lot of incentives, and it cost a lot of money, and I'm not sure that that can be done. But we did some things wrong in the wind industry. We got to correct that. The biggest thing we faced was the corporate tax credit, and I don't know how to change that on the state level, and we keep hoping for something in Washington, and who knows what they'll do out there. I think XL has tried to get more local PPAs signed. John Deere has stepped up to the plate and bought some tax credits and helped some projects that I know others around the table have put together. People around this table did tremendous work in putting the seabed legislation together, and we need to go forward with that. But what we're up against right now, the euro dollar hit $1.38 on Friday, and when the corporations were buying turbines, it was on parity. How do we handle that now? And the project costs get so expensive that Karen Hyde has to look at that every day. How do the ratepayers afford to pay for those European turbines? And we have to address that issue. Otherwise, what's happened with this European currency cost, there's a lot of seabed projects out there, Mr. Chairman, that have put in a bid, didn't have their turbines bought, and how the hell are they going to pay for them now? And we got some other problems that are coming up. And those things we need to address, they're just not going to work. But thank you.
Senator Metzen was here, just left. You're right. And one of the things that has to be stimulated is the attraction of manufacturing facilities here. And one of the things we're going to, you know, which is not a slam dunk, and the deed has been charged with developing a strategy, and we think it does. It overlaps very much with this whole concept, as you said. It may not be viable if you can't get your supplies at a decent price. So later on, not much later this morning, we're going to touch that subject and gauge the interest of the members and see what we should do with respect to that.
I'm Carl Nelson with Green Institute and also representing Minnesota Project. I'm a relative newcomer to this group and appreciate the chance to be here. I think there's been a lot of great work that's already been done, and happy to be part of the group that's rolling up their sleeves to see how we're going to take it to the next level. I'll be brief in my comments. We did put together a two-pager of principles for determining seabed project eligibility, so I won't go over that. But the goal of that was to try to see with, you know, some things that we could generally agree on, that what seabed was all about. And one of them is that, you know, that we'd look at trying to avoid an overly prescriptive legislative changes as we look at the charge of the committee and try to leave some flexibility in the actual definition. I don't know that Mike's leaving the room now because he knows that that's going to be him that has to come up with those specific things. But I think that is having that flexibility is going to be important to be able to deal with a rapidly changing industry, as many of the people have pointed out. Problems with turbine price increases, fluctuating euro, and how that factors into the economic model. You know, trying to come up with a specific percentage can be challenging. So, you know, how do we get some general principles we can put in statute, and then try to have you know, either Mike or PUC or something come up with some flexible rules for determining what exactly a seabed project is, and try to deal with some of the issues that others have brought up. Ryan, I very much agree with the risk return comment there. I think that you can design a project to get a certain percentage of returns, but you might have a project that involves more risk to local owners that way, and there might be a way where they get a little bit less, but they ultimately are more assured of getting it, or maybe they can get it faster. So dealing with a sort of equation that deals with that, I think, would be a positive thing as well. In terms of looking at the actual contractor that is chosen, I think, I don't know if we're going to talk about that anymore today, but...
We will.
Okay, all right. So I won't say anything about that. And I guess just in closing, Green Institute has been involved primarily in non-wind technologies. I personally have been involved in some wind projects, but Green Institute is more interested in some other technologies that are just on the horizon with becoming on the scale of wind. It's going to be another 10 years before we get solar to the level of where it is with wind now, but that might be something that this committee should think about. Now, I don't think we need to think about that until after January 15th, if this is indeed extended, but I would be interested in thinking about that at some later date as well.
Carl brings up an important point, and so did Mr. Nichols, which, I mean, there is a huge tension between do we want to pass a statute, because if we pass the statute, we foreclose some good projects maybe. And obviously there can be job owning. We could have no statute and just say, get it done. And everybody understands, you know, and it's private. So, I mean, there's people have to really be thinking about what's the appropriate way to address this in a situation that we can't look in a crystal ball and know 5 years from now what's good for the local communities or not. So I think you really should have an open mind. We have to be innovative. Think about what's the best process to get to the result that you want. Is it to load up a statute? Is it for the legislature to be active? Because the reason the legislature did not act, one of the reasons was that the stakeholders could not agree. And it was very difficult. It seemed like there were things that looked seemingly, you know, like we said before, and there was disagreement. And we didn't have the wisdom or the desire to say, you're not in the ballgame, because they looked pretty good, some of them, you know, and they were some of your folks. And so it was not a unanimous front coming in and saying, this is what we want you to do from the farm community. You know. Go ahead.
I'm Stuart Mitchell from the Public Utilities Commission. And I'm not going to add a great deal to what's been said. I want to say, first of all, that the commission has kind of consciously adopted a policy of watching developments at the legislature and not trying very much to influence them. Secondly, I'm only a substitute for Burl Haar, who was not in the office today, and so I'm here on his behalf. I just want to say that we are here as a kind of a statutory member of the group, and we are here because it's our job very narrowly to review and approve power purchase contracts, and more generally, I think it's the commission's job to balance the interests of the ratepayers and the utilities, and to the extent that reviewing power purchase contracts is a part of that, that's the primary reason we're here.
Understood. You're not seen as an advocate. You're seen as a resource in a lot of ways. Thank you.
Hi, Mike Michaud, and I've been around watching the wind develop in Minnesota for a while, too, like Paul has. And in the earlier days, there projects were mostly single-turbine projects, and as time has gone on, we've seen the rise of bigger-size turbines and bigger-size projects, and I think it's important for us to keep in mind that the smallest size project can still be seabed. You know, there's little incentive to go beyond, if you're below 40 kilowatts, you can take advantage of the net metering tariffs. But if you're over 40 kilowatts in size, it's a different ball game altogether. And in the size range, now where a single turbine is maybe 2 megawatts, 2.5, getting a little bigger, maybe we ought to take a look at whether or not the role of feed-in tariffs has some value for those smaller size projects. And along those lines, those smaller size projects can interconnect at distribution level voltages, and you can avoid all the MISO interconnection stuff, most of it, in a non-FERC jurisdictional interconnection regime. And we did succeed in getting a study of that issue passed this last session, and we look forward to that dialogue. But there's lots of opportunity there in the distribution system that we need to look at, and we can avoid the infrastructure investment and transmission along the way, too, if we can develop in that manner. And as one last point, we've talked about a lot of the market barriers for seabed to enter and play in the game with the big boys and the IPPs and so on, and the smaller the project is, the more market barriers there are to playing this game. And so we really need to take a look at whether or not we need to have some special way to encourage the development of smaller seabed projects. And I think this is particularly important now that the definition has changed to include all types of renewable technologies. And Carl mentioned it earlier about PV. What does a PV seabed contract look like now? I mean, technically, they're eligible to play the seabed game. They have certain tax incentives, but they don't have the production incentive that wind does, and so on. And so when we're talking about benefits to the local community, maybe there's a whole new area that needs some investigation. And lastly, in terms of measuring the benefits to the local community, we've been talking primarily about direct costs and direct benefits, mostly, you know, the direct gross revenues from the PPA and the direct flow of maintenance contracts to taxes to the local community. But maybe it's appropriate to take an economist perspective and take a look at the relative economic value of a dollar spent in a community in different ways. You know, a dollar spent for a maintenance technician probably echoes through the community six times, but a dollar invested in a crane for a new local crane company can generate more jobs and so on. And so the relative social economic value of some of these benefits that flow to the economic community, local community, should be maybe measured in those kinds of terms. And getting back to the area of PV, maybe we should take a look at, and even small wind, we should take a look at where's the cost-benefit balance where the ratepayer maybe pays a little more, but because the ratepayer is part of that community and there's a net benefit to the community, it's worth it for us as a state to think that a PPA that on the face has a cost higher than the market is still cost effective for the community and the state as a whole. So I'll stop there.
Thank you.
I'm Dan Jewell from Woodstock, and I'm on the Seabed Initiative Board, and also I do this seabed for a living. I help communities get involved in energy production as an economic development tool. You know, why Seabed was formed or why Seabed came to being, I think, I don't know if it was Frank Zappa who said it, but necessity is the mother of invention. I know he was in the mothers of invention, but I don't know. Anyway, and that's what it was. It was necessity. We were out there doing this stuff, building wind farms and working with the big wind farms, and we started looking at where is the dollars going. And where we live in the southwest corner of the state, we have hundreds and hundreds of megawatts of wind turbines running. And we started looking at where do these dollars go, and we saw that we were literally exporting tens of millions, $50, $60 million a year to foreign multinational companies. And so Seabed is great as far as the economic development and the jobs that we do by using local contractors and everything. But the big kahuna is the retention of the energy dollars in our community. That's the long-term livelihood and lifeblood of what this thing is all about. And that's why we did Seabed. Seabed was basically designed, we had to come up with a way to get people to understand that this is possible. We can do this. It isn't a pipe dream. And we needed to address the hurdles. We identify the hurdles and then address the hurdles to say this is what we need to do to make it easier for communities to get involved in their own energy production. And so that's why we have Seabed. And it was the original Minnesota incentive program kind of was the incubator, and that showed us that, wow, we can do this and we can keep out dollars in our community. And then when that came to a screeching halt because of budgetary constraints, we said we need to develop a mechanism that can do this and help our communities do this that doesn't require tax dollars. And so we said, let's look at this thing on the net present value real time of this energy over the life of the contract, and we can front load them. We create jobs and economic development on the front end, and we create long-term, low-cost energy in the back end. Because you have to remember the difference between Seabed and the other developments is that we're the ratepayers too. We're the taxpayers. We're the ratepayers. We're the people out there that are buying this energy. We don't just make it. We buy it. And so there's a big difference in our whole philosophy. And Seabed, the stuff that we've done with Seabed is the only of all of the development you see out there that is able to bring manufacturing into this state. The Suzlon plant in Pipestone is the only manufacturer in the state that was brought here, and they came here because of the work we're doing with community-based development, and they see the values of that. The others don't care. The big companies don't care. They don't care about us. I mean, they care, but they don't care about our communities the way we do. And so we made the special effort to say, well, we'll use your turbines, but we want you to come and be part of our community too. And so we leveraged that, and that's, you know, so it does do that. And, you know, we're learning about the cost. Karen was very right I mean, the interconnection queue and the turbine access are two big, big problems for everybody, not just the seabed. So part of the thing that we're doing with the seabed initiative is to aggregate community-based projects together around, use a combined mindset to have buying power and to buy turbines at the level that the others do. And, you know, I don't care what anybody says. I buy these things all the time, and there's not that big of a difference between buying a whole bunch and a few of them because they're still all handmade. They're all handmade. And you get some economies of scale, but not what everybody seems to think it is. And we want the utilities. We don't think the utilities are a competitor to us, like somebody earlier said. We want the utilities to be seabed. We want them to partner with community-based development because we're partners with them already. We buy the energy. They produce the energy. We would much rather see the utilities become partners in seabed than anybody because they are already part of our community, and we want to make them healthier also. So, you know, there's a lot of things we can look at this, and, you know, the definition of who is seabed, it's amazing how all of a sudden when community-based development all of a sudden became something, everybody wanted to be it. And, you know, I think we need to draw some lines. There needs to be lines in the sand drawn. If we want to keep our energy dollars in our community, we need to do it, and I'm not sure where those lines are drawn, and that's what hopefully will come out of this meetings that we have. But it's imperative that we understand that the values of keeping our energy dollars in our community is huge, and it's not something that we just need to say, oh, well, we want everybody to play. And the risk-reward thing, I mean, if a landowner doesn't want to be part of a community-based project, and we've seen this many times, by God, his nephew does, or his wife's cousin does, he doesn't have to be involved. If he's 75 years old and he's looking at a condo in Florida, he doesn't have to be involved in the community-based development just because he owns the land. He can still rent his land to his cousin or his nephew or his wife's brother, whoever. And so, you know, the risk out there is people want the risk. When we did the Minwin project in Rock County, we needed to raise $6.4 million for that project. It was about a $13 million project. And we had two meetings, and we raised that $6.4 million, no problem. And we had to turn 100 people away because people want to invest in their communities, and they see this as a vehicle to do that. So hopefully we'll be able to get some of these issues on the table and get them put to bed. But we do need to have a definition that says this is community-based. This does keep the dollars in our community. And the others don't.
Thank you.
I'm Larry Johnston with Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. We're a wholesale generation and transmission company like GRE, but on the municipal side, serving 18 municipal utilities around the state. Again, as far as why seabed has existed, obviously I think everybody's on the same page that we're trying to capture as much local investment as we can and benefit to the community. I do think that's where things start to cross into where Beth was at, though. What's ideology and what constitutes local benefit and what is good, and don't at some point in time don't let the good become, you know, the perfect become the enemy of the good, and make sure that you get certain projects accomplished. Like Glenn, in several RFPs that we did last year, the vast majority of the respondents to the RFPs, frankly, were seabed projects. As a matter of fact, the only people who kind of instantly removed themselves from the process were one of the big companies that we may, in fact, be worried about. So at the moment, I'm always impressed by how poorly things work in a shortage. And when you can't either get things through MISO or there's insufficient transmission, or there's no turbines, or interestingly enough, the turbines that there are all owned by the same set of investor groups. It's not too terribly surprising to me that it's very difficult to get projects put together. So I'm real interested in kind of the concepts that have been talked about in terms of aggregating financing. I'm very interested in looking at different model structures. Very much like all the rest of the utilities in the room, this isn't simply a deal for us to look at and say, how does it work in 5 years? How does it work at year 10? I want to know how it works at year 20. I want to know what's going to happen after year 20. Those turbines that we build and own ourselves, and I think Dan just made a perfect argument for public power, I might add. That sounds like community-based energy. I've kind of always thought that was maybe the case. But from that standpoint, we've looked at longer-term arrangements with the landowners, any number of things. We need to know what's going to happen out there. One of the tasks that's a trick for us is in knowing how all this works in the first place. Glenn suggested, you know, we want to make sure that somebody's around there to service the turbines. We've been working on wind for quite a few years ourselves. I'm still constantly amazed at a technology that we think is horribly mature at this point in time, still has what I consider to be enormous challenges in terms of operation and maintenance and stability. So those are challenges long-term for people in terms of being able to adequately fund maintenance to make sure that the resources that we put there now are going to be there long-term and in that wind shed, regardless of what deal is restructured. So those are horribly important to me. I'm not sure that anyone, sometimes when I speak to them, can actually suggest how a flip structure will work in year 11. And whether or not all the IRS definitions in terms of what the value of the project is and how it's going to transfer at the end of that time will, in fact, be that way 10 years from now and will work that way. So these are enormous challenges, and I think it hits back against trying to evaluate, again, what is that local benefit? What are the models? And I don't think model. What are the models that we want? Maybe even approaching that risk and reward. Maybe there should be all kinds, an array of opportunities for people in local communities to invest in these projects. I think at the moment we've said that historically a model might be the, you know, hate to pick on FPL Energy, but it might be the FPL Energies of the world, building a project and having it there, and somehow that then becomes the demarcation of the enemy. And so, therefore, so I'm real happy to hear about this partnering with developers, with independent power producers, with utilities. We have an enormous challenge of getting a reasonable amount of wind on the ground. And we need to find a way to get that done, not to carve up little fiefdoms. But in that vein, if the model is local ownership needs to replicate FP&L, I think you're going to have a handful of projects that can put that together. I think if you have models and structures that suggest you can have an array of ownership and investment opportunities that return value, I think you're likely to get a whole lot more projects done. This is something that isn't conceptualized as a model at all, but interestingly enough, when I first came to the agency, we were financing projects based on something called mini bonds. And they were sold to members of the community that were investing in projects. And those sold like hotcakes because people in the municipal community were, in fact, interested in helping finance and getting a return on the energy infrastructure that they were buying the energy off of. I mean, they saw it as a very complete loop. I'm not suggesting that that's a replacement for what we're doing, but on the other hand, maybe there's an array of opportunities, you know, that we ought to look at along that line. So my thought is we need to make sure that we're thinking long term. From SEMPA's standpoint, we may recognize even that there could be, again, we're all talking about how do we make seabed competitive. That is clearly our goal. But we recognize that there may even be instances based in this scenario that seabed may be at a premium. And I'm not willing to just out of hand suggest that a premium is off the table, but I sure the hell want to know what that premium is. And that premium, in fact, relates very clearly to the local benefit. And we need to understand what those things mean. So I think we've kind of taken ourselves into a very small model box, which is to take what we see happening with the IPPs and saying we need to make little individual ownership IPPs, and that's the solution. I think it's likely to be one of the solutions, but it's not likely to be the only one.
Thank you. We had a late arrival here. Paul?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Paul Johnson, Minnesota Power. Happy to finally get here. I was experiencing that other season in Minnesota called road construction. And finally made it here. My responsibilities at present with the company are to work with resource planning, similar to Glenn. We're in the process of preparing that long-term filing right now, due in November. A key component of that, as you might imagine, is the RPS. A key component of that is to address the seabed component of wind, in this case. Secondly, I have been running the RFPs for the company for the last 3.5-4 years. A key component of those two all-source RFPs, one in 2004, the second one that was sent out in February of this year, is the renewable solicitations. We've received very solid responses from a wind standpoint to both of those RFPs. The second one in February received a seabed response as well. And along those lines, our experience coming out of that, the third part of my responsibility is actually to negotiate and navigate those PPAs through the commission for approval in the case of wind. I'm happy to say we've gotten two seabed PPAs through that process. And the first of those projects went live on July 6th near Hewitt, Minnesota, 2.5 megawatt Nordex turbine. How did we get there? The one word that seems to rise frequently in people's mouths here today is flexibility. I think we, both parties at the table, both the utility in this case and the seabed developer, we worked very hard at identifying each other's needs in the context of the statute and what's currently there and how that works and how it's meant to work. I think intent and goal came up a lot in our discussion. What's the real intent here? What are we really trying? What's the seabed legislation trying to accomplish? And as a result of that, we ended up with two projects. In terms of the, I think Jenny asked me when I was just sitting down, the list, the items 1 through 11, I think the scope of that is comprehensive, especially number 11, where it says any other topics related to or impacting seabed program as determined by the task force. I think that covers us in terms of being adequate. Why was seabed formed or created? I wasn't around when, I mean, really involved in seabed in the early days. I think other people have spoken very eloquently and to a great extent about that, but I can speak only to the application of it, and I think it's worked well for us to get two projects. Going forward, I think what I would ask, our company would ask for, is maintaining the flexibility, tracking with the changes that the legislation has to track with the changes in market and opportunities going forward. I think if you set overall goals and intent of what you're really trying to accomplish and let the paths to get there kind of deviate and be what they need to be for a given project, I think that's important to specify all the different bus stops from point A to the end point, telling you have to stop at all these intermediary stops along the way, and if you don't, it's not seabed. I don't think that's the way to go about this, based on our experience. You start here with a goal, with an encouragement to add seabed projects to your portfolio, in this case, Minnesota Power. And then here's the goal of the destination over here. We're trying to do this. We're trying to accomplish this. We're trying to, in terms of structuring, the structuring for seabed typically is for a rural setting with farmers. but Minnesota Power finds itself in a mining area with a lot of trees around. We don't have a lot of corn and wheat growing in our service territory, and so the structuring for those kinds of seabed projects as they are presented needs to reflect that. And so that's a non-typical kind of seabed project that would fit that very unique site, and the participants, the ownership structure would be different. It wouldn't be farmers in that case. let's see here. It's taking from a planning perspective, company perspective, the overall cost has to be acceptable to the customer. It has to be least cost option in the sense, given the options we're looking at and we're evaluating, it has to be the best we can find at a given point in time. We can't predict what those projects are going to be a year from now or 2 years or 5 years from now, but what we have to deal with at a time that we're making a decision to add wind resource to our system, it has to pass that criterion of being an acceptable cost resource. I think that's it for now.
Thank you. Do you have something?
Yeah, before we proceed, I just wanted to acknowledge the presence of legislators who have been listening to our discussion. I know Senator Metzen was here earlier, but I think he left. But Senator Sheeran is here, and also Representative Aaron Peterson and Representative David Bly. I would just say if you'd like to address the task force, now would be as good a time as any.
There's an open seat where Tom Peterson.
I'm not going to take much time.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Beth, for letting me have your seat. From what I understand, having authored it since the majority changed, seabed, is that if it's too complicated, these manufacturers, turbine suppliers, whatever, other countries, other currencies, are happy to take on that work if it's too complicated. I'm just thinking about the example in the scale issues. Washington State, you know, they had about 0 megawatts in 2000, 2001. Now they're up to about 900. And the Atlantic Array off of the British coast, the southwest coast of Britain, 1,500 megawatts offshore. And then you read about somebody in Texas, north of Amarillo, who's going to do 2,000 to 4,000 megawatts of wind. So if we make it too complicated, I think somebody will go someplace else. And having gone to the wind conference in Los Angeles, it became pretty clear that people want to talk about community energy because it's popular and it's easy to put on your web page and it's good to be for. But it was just kind of a side conversation in that, oh, you guys from Minnesota do all that seabed. We don't really don't know what it is, but we know that we use it in our PR. I think Mr. Nichols brought up a very good point. Wind model versus ethanol model. I appreciated Mr. White's historical perspective coming from the Kennetech 25 project in Lincoln County. And I just of the mind, what I'm hearing here is that, you know, Suzlon might be community type or community in Pipestone, but I believe they've signed a humongous order and expanded it for, you know, millions and millions of dollars with PPM, and where are those turbines going to go? And do those types of turbines work on the Buffalo Ridge? Because when I was down there last week, the ones that were working were the non-Suzlon turbines. And I mean, the $1.38 for the euro dollar is pretty clear to me. And if you've only got 3 gearbox manufacturers mainly in the world, you know, it seems like that vertical integration with pigs in the 1990s as to, yeah, you can be a part of it and you can have a piece of it and you take on the liability. So if all of that stuff spills into the local creek, it's your problem, not ours. So I see the part about risk, and if your turbine breaks and you've got too much risk and you're not making any money because you got to get the crane and the this and the that, all the things you people know. But I hope that we you actually get to a point, this is your task force, and I hope between now and February, as you're all aware, no votes are going to be taken by any legislators. And it seems to me that the vote count is really three. You need three in the House and three in the Senate on the conference committee. You can have 68, you can have 34, you can have the governor, you can do all this stuff, but the real vote count is three. So I'm not going to tell you what I think about the next bill, if you will, in a non-budget year. But, oh, Mr. Yarno, that was a good point, too. I thought, okay, now, if you're going to include the infrastructure and the supply chain and the this and the that in the definition, is that going to be reflected in the PPA, or do we need to come up with something else out of commerce or deed or the tax bill that never passed, you know what I mean, to incent this type of activity, not so much reflected in the PPA and getting into the interconnection queue part, the supply chain that I've heard. Maybe it's not this statute that would get into the net present value and the this and the that over how these companies in Southwest Minnesota who are happy to provide the parts, and they're doing it. They need more labor, though. Labor I saw last week constructing transmission line wasn't any IBEW worker from Minnesota, but all those people came and stood at my press conferences and said that we really like this stuff. So it's happening without us, and it's happening at a big, big scale. So I'm hoping that this group actually gets into the details, maybe not on the first meeting, but gets into the details of because a lot of you are competing against each other, and maybe you don't want to share what your plans are. Gets into the details of what should count, what should not count, and so. But I'm not naive enough to think it's actually going to be such that people are going to stop working on it in February, and then we're going to have a committee and a vote and a this, and then Mr. Eliff's going to put it together on our side, and such, and then there's going to be late stress, chippy attitudes and language from people working for those three votes on the conference committee. So it's going to change a lot between now and whenever we actually get a bill going. But I thought I remember the first meeting of the Electric Energy Task Force that said we were going to have a seabed task force. I believe in the record it stated that there was going to be an independent outside moderator hired to do this between the next coming meetings. I hope that's the case, and that everybody can spar and yell, kick, and scream to this guy we don't know. I think that'd be beneficial, because it is helpful that if you have that opportunity. So thanks, Beth, for your seat, and I don't know how long you're going to keep going today, but this manufacturing deal, I think we can all get on that one. Getting some of that into the states, you know, yes, provincially, if I want it in my district, and it should be the best ever. But, you know, if it's in the region, that would be very, very, very beneficial. The parts that are on the euro dollar right now, we need to get that made in America. I think that'd be, or maybe it's not this task force charge, but it's no short of Governor Pawlenty's involvement that it's going to take to get that to happen. So hopefully that would help everybody who's got, you know, trying to integrate this process such that it actually happens in the upper Midwest and in Minnesota rather than other places, which is going to happen there anyway, but we should have our rate of change equal theirs.
Mr. Chairman, Dan didn't mention it, but SMI at Porter, we have one tower manufacturer, and probably because you bought the tower, so I had to guess, Dan. We have one blade manufacturer, Suzlon, and probably, again, you bought their blades. These are local projects. These foreign corporations don't buy anything locally. Now, hopefully, we'll have a steel mill on the range, and if we don't do it right, we're going to be making billions of pounds of steel, and turbines take billions of pounds of steel, but it'll be imported steel. When I talk to Vestas to buy a turbine now, say, well, you know, the blades and the tower are going to come overseas. No, it won't. I'll go to another company, you know. Not interested. But that's what happens when you don't have local involvement. We'll never get any manufacturing. We'll be like South Dakota and North Dakota.
That's an important point. I propose now your homework assignment is broad. This is what I'm thinking. how are we going to proceed, best use of your expertise and time. I think on this issue, I want to get the reports back from you. We'll put them together. This is, you know, I didn't hear anybody say they didn't want local benefit from this wind development. So I didn't hear anybody oppose that. So the question is, you know, how do you do it? You know, what are people comfortable with, their needs? So we get a list of people's concerns. We put them together. And driving it is, you know, how do we get the local benefit? And here's our people's concerns that we have to be addressed. So we'll circulate that to people. You can respond to it, think about it, come back, and we'll have that sort of exchange. And then we are thinking of hiring an expert. Obviously, what we can do is we can send out an RFP with the statute in it. You know, that gives us our charge. And how you want to, if you want to add anything to that, because that's pretty indefinite, I think it would be helpful to get somebody in who has skills in this development area and knows what can sort of quantify local benefit and give us expertise on it. I don't know if it's an accountant or somebody who's involved in the business. I assume they might be too busy. We won't pay them enough. We do have $250,000. We've done it once before. We had a big contract in the 90s for $150,000 to do something, and I'm not sure we got value out of that one, okay, through nobody's fault. So we want to make sure we spend the money wisely, and I think we can. So if you have thoughts on that, I mean, we are going to hire somebody who's going to listen to you folks and try to help us develop a model or tell us if we shouldn't have a model, how we should do it, you know, how it should be implemented, what's the best way, what's a dynamic model we can use, or get to where we want to get once we decide where we want to get, which I think we want to get local benefit and once we address these concerns. So this, I think it was Carl who asked if we were going to talk about it later, and this is the later. So if you had some thoughts, anybody has any thoughts on what sort of information we should be getting, it's on the agenda, and what sort of expertise we need to analyze that information, share those thoughts with us now, because we're going to have to issue an RFP right away, you know, in a week or so. So I invite, we can parrot the statute, which is, you know, the easy way to go, because that's what they have to do.
Well, I mean, my only thoughts, I think, John, you've already said what they were, is that we get somebody.
Let me interrupt you, Sam. I'm giving instructions. Mm-hmm. How long are we going to be here? I think we can. I don't think we'd break for lunch, and I think it'll be over within the hour. We have two other things on the agenda, and I want to share with you. It could be shorter than that. If we ever do have an all-day meeting, we will furnish lunch. We will buy sandwiches or something. I don't think that's going to be the case today, because I think Representative Peterson is right. I'm not going to get into details today. I want you to think it over. Think very closely about your homework assignment, because that's going to be what kick back to everybody. Don't leave anything out. You know, what you bring up is what's going to be presented to people as the concerns regarding this issue. So that's think about it. Try to be specific. Sorry, Carl.
Can I interrupt for a second? I see Representative Bly at the table. I assume he has something to say.
I didn't know you. I'm sorry.
Thank you all for being here. I think this is a very important task force, and I represent Northfield Belle Plaine area, and I know Northfield is very interested in the community-based energy development issue, as my constituent Mike Bull, who has left the room, I'm sure could attest to. I think it's really one of the I like following Representative Peterson because he's plain spoken and cuts to the chase. I think he identified really key areas, one being the necessity of manufacturing in our state. That is local and Minnesota-based. I also think that we need to make sure that we protect this option of community-based energy development and not let it be taken over by the forces that he mentioned. I think back to the 70s when energy was a concern and we got distracted. We turned away from all the things we could have been doing, and Europe and other countries have outpaced us. And part of the reason that we have to look elsewhere for that manufacturing is because we let it go. I think that it's really important that we keep our minds on how to make this happen and also to protect the interests that people are. It's in my district, it's a growing concern that we buy locally and that we have local development. I really like Dan Jewell's comment about this is what will bring manufacturing to our state, and this is what will improve our economy in general. So thank you for coming, and good luck with your work.
Thank you. Carl?
Well, I think you kind of stated what some of my key points would be for a contract. I mean, getting somebody with experience in wind project development and financial models, I think, would be important. But what I'm wondering is if we could have a sort of, you know, a list of criteria. Maybe we could even brainstorm a little bit now, and staff could write it down, and we could, you know, have the list that would be that we'd want in a contractor. And the other point I'd make is I don't know that we'd be looking at just one contractor. It seems like developing a scope of work that's really clear and looks at all the different needs that we'd have would benefit us in getting a work product that would be useful for the committee as well. And I don't know that we're going to be able to do that in one meeting or two meetings, but maybe, you know, there's some parsing out of the scope that could be done. Maybe this is involving more than one contractor, actually, and there's some core needs that we have and then some other things we might look at. But, you know, finding somebody that has experience in wind development, preferably in Minnesota, and in financial modeling, seems to me like that ought to be the core of what we're looking at.
Just so the task for the advisory group knows, the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force has assessment authority of $250,000 in each fiscal year, and for the purposes of the task force, and it's assessed against all the utilities by the Commissioner of Commerce. And we, the LCC, Legislative Coordinating Commission, which is, I think, six senators and six reps, usually the powerful ones, they're our overseer, and they approved $250,000 for using fiscal year 2007 assessment authority. So we also have authority in 2008. So there's a potential for $500,000. We're very cautious about spending money, but if it's money well spent. So that's the potential we have. And usually when we hire somebody, which hasn't been very often, so to say this is usually, when we did hire somebody, it was actually the legislative chairs, I think, who interviewed them. So that I'm not sure what process will be used. And we certainly don't want to get somebody who's seen as as biased in some way. So somehow we should probably connect you folks to that. But obviously you're not all going to be involved in interviewing people, reviewing it, but so there'll be some involvement. I would prefer that if you have thoughts on that, you email us this week and we not talk about it because it's getting close to lunch. I mean, your point are well taken, and we have about two other things to take up. One of which is this manufacturing issue. I'd ask that, just for your information, the Department of Employment and Economic Development, would you pass this mm-hmm. was charged in the energy bill, and you'll find it on a one-pager. On page 7, it's a two-sided document. And the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development, in consultation with Commissioner of Commerce and Agriculture and the PUC, shall develop a strategy to obtain the maximum economic benefit of the state and its citizens from the renewable energy activities described by the Renewable Energy Standard Law. The commissioner may hold public meetings and otherwise engage the public to develop the strategy. The strategy must include considerations of both short-term and long-term opportunities for economic benefit. The Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development shall report on the strategy's strategic recommendations to the chairs of legislative committees with primary jurisdiction over energy policy by November 15, 2007, shortly. The report must include recommendations for legislation necessary to implement the strategy. An interim report is due August 1st, next month. The Legislative Electric Energy Task Force, our parent body, shall provide legislative oversight on the strategy and monitor its implementation. This was actually a bill that was carried past the House and the Senate, and the motivation for it was to engage in these activities to get the manufacturers here, to get a strategy. The department did come before the task force and ask for some money to send people to conferences where these manufacturers attend to drum up business, and that was not approved. However, there is an interest amongst, at least I know Excel has an interest in working with the department and thinking about this issue. And so I think it's very much part of our deliberations, as we've seen, people have talked about it. So we don't have a direct role, but I would like to have people review this and keep you posted and ask for your thoughts on what to do. I mean, we would like to make a strong effort to try to attract industry here and get those benefits. So this is not strictly, this is a separate charge, but I think it overlaps with ours, and I think we'll be working with Deed. They're here today, and I think there's interest in that. I think it's a no-brainer, as somebody said, if we can attract a facility here. So that's an issue that's for your information, and if you have any feedback, any thoughts, what you think could be done, you're all developers, you're knowledgeable, you know, what can we do to get these folks to come here? And we'll get a report from the I'll make that available. The August 1st one, I'll make it available. So that's any questions on that? George?
Dan has it.
Oh, Dan?
Reading this, it says the strategy to obtain maximum economic benefit for the state. Mm-hmm. That it kind of goes back to my earlier comments that this is way above manufacturing. Manufacturing's a great deal. Those are great jobs. But the real economic value to the state is keeping our energy dollars in our state. We export, I don't know how many billions of dollars a year buying energy. And so that's, you know, and again, that was the essence of Seabed, was to maximize the value of keeping our energy dollars in our community through the ownership models. And so I think when we look at this, we need to look at it not just from the context of manufacturing, but what is the real value of keeping our energy dollars by generating these through our communities in our state and in our economy.
You should communicate your thoughts with, I mean, indeed, it's Dentley Haggis out here. Yeah. And he's from the department, and Brian McDaniel, I think, is their lead person on it. I've talked to Commissioner McElroy in the session. I mean, I think it's in the interest of the state to explore all the possibilities for, and you're absolutely right. So you can put, then if you turn the page over, you'll see, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I'm just wondering from the department, maybe if you could address how much interaction you've had with other states that have been able to attract manufacturing. You know, would it be valuable to just broker some meetings between states that have been able to attract manufacturing to understand, you know, how they've done that, or are you already aware of that? Or
you're going to tell us.
You know, is it talking to manufacturers about what they need to come here? Maybe if you could just address a little bit of what you've already done.
Identify yourself.
I'm Dentley Haggisuk for the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, and I think it is good to get as much intelligence about what you're doing before you actually do it. However, in the case of other states telling us their secrets, I don't think they will. It wouldn't be a long trip because Iowa has three manufacturers and a fourth on the way. There are only 10 turbine manufacturers in the world that really count at utility scale, and they've got four of them. So we're a little late to the party, but we've established a pretty good relationship with a couple of them that we're working on, and there's also a local possibility as well. A startup, but a very auspicious one. So we're doing what we can. We don't really have a strategy as such yet, except to get up in the morning, get on the phone, write letters, emails, go to see people. And it is very important, by the way, that this activity get funded, because yesterday, for example, I spent the whole day in an airplane with a gentleman who's looking for a place to put a commercial-scale cellulosic ethanol plant. And we had to charter an airplane. It cost $2,000, and there goes our coffee money for the whole year. So we're going to need to fund that activity if it's going to get done.
I think I was hurrying along, and I forgot to mention something, which is related to the fact that we have this money. If one of the proper purposes, I think, to expend this money would be probably to engage in some of these activities, perhaps, about economic development. I think that's part of the overall task force charge, is to create a sustainable electric industry in Minnesota, and the manufacturing might be part of that. So that's the other reason I laid on the table. Do we want to make a recommendation? You think it over, not right now, about perhaps the task force should take some of its resources and do something. We felt we couldn't fund the State Department. It was not appropriate there, and that was the feeling. But we can certainly fund the activity. And so if people think about that, there's some economic development activity that seems to have a high return in your mind that could use some funding, it could be brought before the members of the task force for them to consider. It would not be a slam dunk, and it might be difficult, but that's something to think about.
John, just a quick follow-up. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't know what kind of questions to ask if we don't know. I'm not sure everybody in the room knows what the department is doing, for example. So, I mean, we could maybe come up with some things, but they may think, well, we're already doing that, or they're goofy, or I just think we could use a little education on what's already being done.
Well, it would not be the department. What I was thinking, and your point's well taken, would be that as we can hire other consultants, do we want to hire somebody who would stump the world, the task force? For Minnesota, go about it wouldn't necessarily be giving money to the department. They would work with the department. It could be, but that was not acceptable earlier. So it would be our own set of activities. So if he wants to talk about that, that's fine. If you want to hear him right now, but I was thinking larger than that as well. You know that we the task force. You could bring somebody to the task force and say, "You have $500,000. We're trying to do the seabed. One of the impediments to seabed is the supply chain. Can we get a supplier here? Is this a good? You know, do you want to spend some money in exploring this? See what we have to do." That was what I was thinking. Did you want to address with her question, Mr. Hagesack?
This is kind of what we do. I mean, we do get up in the morning and try to develop projects. And the gentleman sitting next to you. Wrote a proposal for the first project I worked on. It took me 3 months after I started as a consultant, not as an employee, to attract an $80 million project. And it's all because of Bob's wonderful proposal. But I think the human resources are in place, but the financial resources are not.
It's possible they could rethink it. I mean, it caught them off guard, but I don't know. It was a fairly... wasn't a real strong positive reaction, but I think we can revisit it. The second issue is this property rights that people have talked about. And I don't know if the committee task force is aware, but we did do two things with property rights. We actually amended the underlying real estate law and said a wind easement to install wind turbines on real property, option or lease of wind rights shall also terminate after 7 years from the date the easement is created or lease is entered into, if a wind energy project on the property to which the easement or lease applies does not begin commercial operation within the 7-year period. Okay, so we did that. We made a substantive change of law, but then we also, on this page 6 on this document, which is one side of it, section 4, if you look at that, the task force is charged to study whether the state should regulate easements. Well, we did it. Leases and other agreements to acquire an interest in real property for the purpose of wind energy development. The purpose of the study is to determine whether the duration and other terms of those interests should be limited to promote wind energy development. The task force must report the results of its study and any recommendation to the chairs of the committees by February 1. So in short order. So obviously that impacts the seabed function here too. I mean, that's the land on which you're building a property. So I think we should be interested in that. And Bob has done some work in exploring getting, I think we need some real estate expertise on this. You know, what can we do? What have other states done? So we might hire an expert on this as well. And so we'll be in communication with you on this. We'd like your thoughts so you think about it. Beth Soholt mentioned that she thought we need a fuller discussion of this issue, so perhaps we should devote a meeting to it or part of a meeting, our next agenda, and sort of get the underlying lay of the land, what's happening, you know, what should happen, what's a wise course to promote wind development in Minnesota, what do you need? Go ahead. Okay. So that's another item for the future. You think about that. I think we'll put it on the agenda. I think it's a reasonable and a wise thing to do to have a hearing and have a full discussion on it. And it can be part of our work as well. I mean, it's the task force. and we're working for the task force, and so we can do these all these three things at the same time, I think. So are there any questions? Anything you think we should do? What does our agenda say here? So we're gonna put an RFP out for a real estate expert. We're gonna put an RFP out for the CBID issue using the statute, plus you have this week to give us comments. We have two from Carl, which is should be familiar with wind development in Minnesota and should have experience in rural development?
Financial modeling?
Okay. I think those are reasonable. I didn't hear any objection to that. So that's what we're doing moving forward. I want you to get your thoughts to us. You know, you're running the show. You give us your thoughts. They'll be reflected in the document, and then people can respond to them. So we're not going to edit out anybody's thoughts at that stage. It'll be available for people to talk through. I think people are on board that nobody's opposed to the notion that we should try to get, for the underlying purpose of CBID, which is to get energy dollars to rural Minnesota, or however you want to express it. And so the question is, how do you do it? What the model you use? How can we facilitate it? You know, what are people's concerns? Obviously, it's tied in with the RES. They have off-ramps. We can't build a model that doesn't work financially or for reliability, or the RES may disappear or be delayed or modified. So we have to be cognizant of that. That's what's driving us. So anybody have any comments?
Tom. Just one. This is either an issue of committee makeup or available testimony or expertise, but I think it would be useful if there were other parties around the table that do financing, tax equity, not just us, perhaps in Edison, available to have these conversations, since it's been noted several times that we play a significant role in this field. But I also want to make sure that the fuller scope of voice is heard from that perspective.
Fuller? A relative of mine.
Not another Fuller.
Yeah, my sense is, it's people are accepting of this notion of CBED. And that people are willing to, if you sit here, you think, what's the problem? It seems like everybody's on the same, they're talking. But there obviously are some hurdles to overcome. So it seems to me that we'll start this conversation as a group. We'll send out the thoughts. And then, the people, the developers, the utilities are here, And so they should obviously have have some conversations, and we'll hope to facilitate that, because all the players are here. This is where it's going to happen. That's why, the buyers and the sellers are here. So, next meeting. Go ahead.
Okay. Before we start talking about kind of next steps, we'll continue talking about next steps and when we're going to have our next meeting. Everybody in their folder should have this reimbursement form. And if you are interested in getting reimbursed by the Electric Energy Task Force for your mileage to and from this meeting, make sure that you fill this out and then give it to me before you leave today. And then we'll have the chairs of the LETF sign those and then get you reimbursed. Also, in order for the Legislative Coordinating Commission Accounting Department to process the reimbursement forms, they need your social security number and your mailing address information so that they can get you your check. So the person that you need to contact in the Legislative Coordinating Commission is Sandy Horman. Her last name is spelled H-O-R-M-A-N. And so you need to get her your social security number, your address. Her phone number is 651-296-5370. And her email, if you feel comfortable emailing your social security number, is sandy.horman, H-O-R-M-A-N, at lcc.ledge.mn. And I can email that information out to folks, too, so that you can get your reimbursement for being here. We appreciate your participation. Okay.
Anybody have a thought they'd like to share for the group now? Yes, John.
Real quick, in terms of expertise that might help us, regardless of whether or not this person is at the table, if we're going to have a number of models that will qualify qualify as CBED, and we'll all work toward the goal of maximum rural economic development. Real quickly, you start to bump into the vagaries of tax law and how to cruise underneath SEC regulation and what happens after 10 years. Is this a valuable thing you're flipping, or is it only worth a dollar? And all of that stuff comes into play when you're looking at the risk and the return to the community from a model and also the cost of setting something up. So unless, you know, one of us has got all of that stuff nailed down, we may want to consider having some of that expertise part of what we end up doing.
Right. I mean, I think it's a clear field. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if you came back and they said it's really difficult. Experts said this model thing is not a good idea. You know, you should just do it. I mean, when you're right, there's more trouble than it's worth or something. And that may be the case. I mean, that may not be the way to go. May not work for you folks, but I think we do need, because there's been disputes about the extent of revenue that goes back to people and what's a good amount, that we should try to get somebody, put out a request for proposal, see what we get. We may not get anybody that we feel comfortable with. There's a lot of expertise at this table and around that we, you know, as well, but I think we're going to start out by seeing what we can get. You're right. Yeah, we need all that stuff. I'm not a big fan of a lot of meetings, so I think we'll wait to see what happens when you feed it back. If we can work back and forth and communicate, and you have, it can be more thoughtful. The earliest would probably be in September, but I think, you know, I appreciate all your thoughts. You've been real friendly and helpful, and really, and I think we can continue through email and work on stuff and then meet again and see what works for people, and probably have another meeting. There was some thought at one time to go out to the windy areas, but I'm not sure when and what would be the topic and what would be the benefit necessarily. So get your thoughts on that as well. If you think there's something that would be worthwhile to go out to southwestern Minnesota where we would learn something we couldn't otherwise learn, or people would appreciate that opportunity to be there, you know, that's something we would consider. It's quite expensive for mileage for some people, so there is that thought too. But so think about that. It might be helpful. If you think it's helpful, let us know on what the topic would be, and we would consider it.
Feel free to leave your folders here, and then we can stuff them for the next meeting. If you want to take the documents that are in your folders home with you, then that's fine. Otherwise, you can leave them here, and we'll just keep them in your folders.
Comments in right away on the expertise for the contractor, and then your within the next week or two on your thoughts on CBED and what you think should be considered. That would be appreciated. And we'll try to get it back to you within, you know, say we give you 2 weeks, we try to get it all back to you within the next 2 weeks. And so you would have it by the middle of August, and then we could done.
Ever since Dan Jewell spoke, you've all been wondering who actually did say necessity is the mother of invention. And I told Dan it was actually Plato.
But usually you don't use Plato and Frank Zappa in the same sentence. Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming. The meeting's adjourned.
So you're going to use email to come up with a date?